Bill Alcoholic.
You know, there are Harlans all over Alcoholics Anonymous. He wasn't the only one. I would imagine there's some people he pissed off, you know. The Harlans in Alcoholics Anonymous get stuff done. And they might start off wanting to make a name for themselves in an anonymous organization, you know. Maybe that's the motivation. And as time goes on, if they're successful, if they get stuff done, they fall in love with everybody. And they realize it's not about them. It's about us. It's about bringing us together. We have a Harlan in the South Bay, a guy named Dave. And it really touched me this weekend when just before we come up here, we find out Harlan passed away, and Karen and I talked about, God, what if we ever lost Dave? Dave brings our community together every year, 34 years. And I know Dave, you know. I mean, I started going to the roundup, and I thought for a while, I want to be Dave, you know, because Dave's in charge. All these guys have control issues. You know? They have control issues. And but you know what's combined with that? They laugh, they smile. They want to bring people together, even if they're motivated by self. I mean, they're the ones that are outgoing. They can be the voice of the thing. There's people that are too frightened to get involved in stuff like this, but they'll attach themselves to Harlan because he's sweet, he's kind, and he's trying to help. He's trying to do something positive. He's not trying to do something negative. He's not telling you how to live. He's telling you, come together, come with us, join the party. How many lives do you suppose this man has saved? How many times I've heard this weekend people talked about when they first came here and when they were brand new, and they've come to every goddamn one, you know? And they're afraid not to come because it seems to be working really well, you know? You know? We need the Harlans, you know? We need them. We miss them when they go. But you know what they do in their wake? They create another bunch of Harlans, you know? And they show them how to do it. They mentor them, you know? And maybe Jason will cut the gray, maybe he won't, you know? It's like, yeah. He has control issues. He's got a nice smile, you know? All the speakers always say, I'm really happy to be here. I really am. About a year ago, I got a liver transplant. It wasn't that long ago, I couldn't walk very well. I've been doing this kind of stuff and traveling around doing AA stuff for a long time. And I haven't been doing it for a few years. And God, I miss it. I mean, don't you just love the energy in this room? I mean, us speaker dudes, we talk about Seaside. We want to go to Seaside. I remember when I hadn't been invited to Seaside, I was pissy about it. I want to go to Seaside. You know, people know about you around the country. Do you know that? You know, we want to go to Seaside. You take really good care of us. You feed us too much, you know. But just the energy of it. We do a lot of these things, and there's some of them that are hot beds of energy. You can just feel it. And I'll tell you something. When I was sick, when I was really sick before the transplant, and I was getting worse and worse and worse, one of the side effects of this was horrendous diarrhea. And I'm just trying to share with you. And who knew Alcoholics Anonymous is a treatment for diarrhea? Somebody calls up, they want you to come out and speak somewhere, and you don't really want to go, you don't feel good, you're full of water, you're retaining water, and you're just sick and you got bad diarrhea. And you can't quit, you know, because you have a reputation to maintain, and so you go. And you walk in the room, and the first thing you do is find the bathroom, and you walk in, and all of you in the meeting look stupid. And then you start talking and you sound stupid. and I'm not hearing the music. You know, I don't feel good. I'm sick, and haven't I done enough? And all this stuff runs in your head. And then somebody takes a cake, or somebody gets a chip. Somebody says something. Just one thing, you know. Maybe they just thank their mother and father, and they get teary-eyed. They get choked up, or somebody says something funny, and you start hearing the music. And then you get up, and you got to talk. And I'll tell you something. I have never pooped on the podium. That's God working in our lives. It's not a cure for diarrhea, but it'll plug it for a while, you know? And then you got about 45 minutes to get home. That's it. You get 45 minutes, and then the glow wears off again, you know? So I'm really happy to be here. I'm happy to be upright. I'm happy to be walking around, and there's a bunch of people here I know that I've seen before, and people come up and say stuff to you, and you just feel the energy that heals me. It heals me. I feel stronger because of it, because I'm not alone, and I feel it. It's a wonderful thing. It's a hard thing to describe. It's something you have to experience. I suspect that most of us here have experienced it. Stop and think about the day you got sober, the day the obsession was lifted. What else do you need to know? You know? I mean, we watch these videos and we see the drunks in the street and stuff, and then we see the smiling faces. Do you notice that the drunks in the street and then the clean people with the smiling faces are the same people? It's us. It's us. And look at this room. There's a room full of people here whose lives have been saved, and a whole bunch of us are conscious of that fact. I mean, conscious of it, awake to it. A lot of us, after a period of time, you start taking it for granted. Every once in a while, you got to stop and think, who the hell you're sitting next to? You know, listen to the story. One thing we proved this weekend, if you heard Magdalena, is the Al-Anons are as screwed up as we are. You know? They're a little crazy, you know? And you listen to the speakers. All of us tell about where we came from and where we are now. Remarkable stories of redemption, of healing, of transformation. Not a small thing. People pay good money for this. I was sitting with an Indian guru one time years ago with a friend of mine that was connected to this man, and he had just given a talk to a bunch of people, and we were in the back room with him sitting just talking, just the three of us. And I'm talking away like I do, and he's looking at me. He starts laughing at me. I said, what are you laughing at? And he goes, I just love you alcoholics and drug addicts. And I said, why is that? He says, well, the rest of them out there are trying to get awakened. You're just trying to figure out what the hell happened. You know? Isn't that true? What the hell happened? I think the rest of the journey is to try to get close to that. What the hell? You know, why that? Why this? Why me? You know? Well, my story is I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran. And I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me. But I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. My biker nickname was Horny. It's... I have it tattooed here on my arm. And it's misspelled. It's H-O-R-N-E-Y. Horne. Three of us determined that's how you spell it. Me and the other two brain surgeons, you know. That's pretty much all you need to know, isn't it? Most all the speakers, people that share and tell a little bit of their story, and we heard it from some of the other speakers this weekend, is, long before I ever drank, I didn't feel part of, I felt weird and strange. You know, the aliens had dropped me off, and I'm waiting for the mothership to return. And we talk about this like it's some unique experience. Sometimes we use the term, we'll say, I had alcoholic thinking long before I ever drank. Alcoholic thinking, as if there is such a thing. You know, you repeat stuff around here long enough, people just pick it up, go, well, yeah, I got alcoholic thinking, man. That's my problem. You know, it's. You know what the professional community says about us? They say that we are emotionally immature. We hear that and we go, no, no. I have special thinking. I have alcoholic thinking and it's never going away. And you need to consider that when you're dealing with me. Uh-huh. And I'm convinced, after 33 years of relatively deep research on the subject, that I, therefore you, are emotionally immature. And what's happening here in AA is we are growing up. And the chances of us doing that and looking good are really slim, you know? And, I think all kids go through that feeling. I think all kids, if you ever raise teenagers, you can see it in them. They're a little weird. They're very, very self-centered, and appropriately so. You know, when you're a teenager, you're supposed to be self-centered, you know? When you're our age, it's really stupid, you know, it's like, God, you know, it's, but we're late, you know, you watch kids grow up. A few years ago, I have two younger kids, they're 36 and 33, and we were having a Christmas party over at my house a few years ago, and my daughter and my son and I were in the living room, and we're just three of us are having a little conversation. My daughter looks at me, and she goes, you know, Dad, you've grown up quite a bit over the years. I looked at her and I was really pleased to hear her say that, you know, because I am convinced I grew up with her. When I got sober, she was 3, and I'm the dad on the T-ball field with his fingers through the chain link fence, screaming at the ref with spit flying out of my mouth, and I'm escorted off the baseball field. I was coaching a soccer team one time of 8 or 9 year olds, maybe 10, and they were really awful. And we were playing this game and we're getting beat like crazy, right? And I got pissed. I started yelling at him. I said, don't you have any pride? You know? And I went over and I just walked off the field in the middle of the game. And I jumped on my Harley that was in the little parking lot where the basketball courts are in this elementary school, right? And I jumped on my Harley, and I burned rubber out of the parking lot. And I'm driving down the street, and I ran out of gas. Remember that? My sponsor is sitting here nodding his head. This is a true story. It's hard to look cool when you got your leather jacket and your helmet, and you're walking down the street, you know, walking home. And I get home, and I'm pissed off and embarrassed and, you know, everything. And I get him on the phone and he says, Bill, it's children's sports. And I actually said, yeah, but you don't understand. You know? I'm better now. So we feel separate. We feel isolated. We feel weird, we feel gawky and geeky and not cool. And then we have a drink. There's two things about alcoholism. One is that when we start drinking, we seem to have no control over when we're gonna stop. That seems to be kind of the essence of the definition, you know? The other thing that we have that other people don't have is we get a bang out of it that other people don't get. You know, we have a life-changing, spiritual, psychic change comes over us. If other people got that, they would drink more. You know, it isn't just the craving. It's we get a hit out of it they don't get. And everything changes. We are now connected. We are not separate anymore. We get taller, clearly smarter, and we go after that. We chase that. We chase it. And so I think the whole idea behind the drinking thing, if I remember correctly, is I'm feeling isolated, not part of, and scared and shy or whatever, and I have that drink. I think the whole idea is to have the drink, get out of the house, go to the party, have some fun, have some adventures, be part of life. I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. I'm having sex, menage a uno, you know? Party, you know? It's like next time some guy walks into one of your meetings and said, well, I'm just a party kind of guy. Ask him, how many other people were at the party you just left, you know? You don't need any other proof that alcoholism is physiological other than that last 3 to 5 years you and I were drinking. No one would consciously do that to themselves if they had any choice over the matter at all. You just wouldn't do it. It's not fun. You know, I'm drinking at the end just to get through the day. I'm not planning on partying anymore. I mean, it's over. That was long, long gone. By the time I was 22 years, at 17, I was a bad drunk in high school. I was walking around with a big jacket and a slouch and a sneer and a foul mouth and a bad attitude, and I had a gun. And I'm a white kid from Palos Verdes, you know. There's no gangs in Palos Verdes. Nobody was looking for me. I was a gang of one, you know. At 17. When the kids started coming into AA, a bunch of guys, a bunch of my old buddies, it was weird to me. It was about, 15 years ago, I think, when they really started flooding in. And they're coming into our meeting, and a bunch of guys said, well, we're not a daycare center. You know, and they left. You know, it's like there's the illusion like these kids are coming to AA because it's so hip. You know, Scott Redmond used to say, Alcoholics Anonymous has offered me a level of lameness that I didn't know was available. You know, I think they're coming here because they need help. I think they need help, right? And I started sponsoring these kids because there wasn't other kids there to sponsor them. So I'm sitting there across the table from a 17, 18-year-old kid. You know what happens when you do that? The age difference goes away. It goes away. And then I realized something. I'm looking at myself when I was 17, 18, 19, 20. That's me. And I needed you then. You know. And I grew up in an AA house. My dad got sober in 1954 when I was 6 years old. You know, but that's just the lame stuff my parents were doing. This was my turn to carry on the stream of alcoholism in our DNA down through the ages. You know, and but the age difference goes away. This one kid in our men's stag, it's a Hermosa Beach men's stag, it's where the men are men and the sheep are nervous. And it's the epicenter of sobriety. And it can be kind of intimidating, you know, because you stand up there to take a cake, you have to stand up at the end of the room, and we are judging you. You know, we're not shy, we'll judge you. And this kid's standing up, and he's 15 years old, he's taken a cake for a year. He's a little short guy, you know, he's like, because he hasn't grown up yet, and he's standing there, and he gave the most right-wing death squad AA pitch I think I've ever heard. And at the end of it, he was standing, and he's pointing and yelling, spits flying out of his mouth. He goes, and if you're sitting out there and you don't have a sponsor and you're not working the steps, may God have mercy on your soul. I went up and asked him to be my sponsor. Kind of scared me, you know. Seventeen, I'm a bad drunk in high school. At 22, I'm in the Oregon State Mental Institution in Salem. Some of you may know that facility. Anybody else out here been in a mental institution? Oh, come on. There's a bunch of you out there going, well, it really wasn't an institution.
They were just observing me. You know?
Don't lie to me. I got married. I came up here to grow my own. It was the 60s. I'm sorry I missed it. But I was there, you know, I was there. I was running with an outlaw motorcycle gang. I'd gotten married. I had two kids. Sticking needles in my arm every day and drinking like a fish and not coming home to that family. And they were on welfare and it was awful. Short party, you know. I could have got sober then. A lot of you do now. I don't remember anybody talking to me about, you know, sobriety. They may have, and I just wasn't paying attention. I don't know. I was in bad shape. I was really strung out. I was on the ward that Ken Kesey worked on when he wrote Cuckoo's Nest. They shot that movie on the ward I was on. Now, I'm not bragging. It's just all I got. This is the high point of the drunkalog. This is it. The rest of it's really boring, you know? And the state of Oregon thought I should leave. There was a bunch of violence, and it was just awful. It was really awful. You know, we laugh about things like that because it's not like that now. But when it's like that, it's not cute. It's not funny. Alcoholism isn't funny, you know. Sobriety is pretty stupid, but alcoholism isn't funny. I came back down to California, and my dad, my sober dad, gave me a job at his machine shop, and he let me sleep in his garage. And I tried to clean up my life, and I tried, like we do. And what that looks like for an alcoholic like me is that you got to quit shooting heroin. You can't get anybody to go along with the concept of social heroin use. There's no support for the position. You got to quit taking acid because normal people have two-way communication with each other, and in acid you don't need the other person, you know. And so what you do is you drink on the weekends and you smoke dope during the week because it's green and it's from God and it's not really drugs. And you do that experiment. You try that, you know. I met another woman, got married, because you can't ever, ever be alone. It is a group effort getting me through life. It takes a village. And you can, that's why they have Al-Anon. There's people that will take us on, you know. And what is that all about, you know? I met her, and we set up housekeeping. We tried to make a life for ourselves, and I had two other kids, two younger kids. And at 37 years old, I'm living in the house with this second wife and these two kids, and I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I didn't know that. I can't stand outside myself and have a separate experience and compare it to the one that I'm having to determine that there's anything wrong. You know, the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one to me because it's the only one I've ever known. It wasn't like I attained something and then I lost it all and I'm trying to retrieve it. I never went anywhere. I didn't do anything. I accomplished nothing. I just got loaded for 22 or 3 years. I just drank, you know. That's what I did. And my life experience was very narrow. I never grew up. I think what happens to us, that feeling of separation that we felt when we were children, was it real? No. Stop and think about it. It is physically and literally impossible to be separate from nature, to be separate from the universe, to be unique, to be a standalone entity. That isn't even possible. Yet we believe it. We feel it. We feel separate. We feel alienated. We feel put upon. When you watch healthy kids grow up during the teenage years when you and I were getting hammered, they had life experiences that they learned from. And somewhere around in their mid-20s, they come out of this self-centered thing. And they start realizing how to have relationships, how to get along, how to line up. I didn't learn that. I wasn't in the room many times when those lessons were being handed out. I'm 37 years old, and on a good day, I've got the emotional development of a 16-year-old, and this kid was not an honor student. He's not mature beyond his years. This is the kid with the problem with authority. That kid. That's who I am. So one morning, drinking all night, nothing special, nothing horrendous. You're sitting in your living room when the sun comes up, and you know it's going to be another miserable day. You're not going to make it to work. You're not going to show up. It's another miserable day. So that morning, like any good gangster, I called my mom. This is a woman that had been in Al-Anon for 30 years by that time. They are organized, prepared, and focused. Right? And she got there inside of a half an hour before I took the nap, you know. And she took me to Costa Mesa and put me in this place called Starting Point. And I spent 35 days in this place. I went to my first shrink when I was 13 because I had rage. Not anger, rage. We had our speaker this morning talked about that rage, that sense of injustice, that there's something wrong and it needs to be fixed. And I would rage. I would bang my head into walls, throw myself on the floor. Bile would come up into my throat, veins throbbing, just pissed off, you know, for some. And nobody beat me. Nobody raped me. Nobody did anything. I don't know where that came from. But I had it. At 13, my mom said, there's something wrong with the boy, and sent me to a shrink. I spent two tours of duty in the mental institution. I went back for a follow-up. I kind of liked it, you know. And I spent 2.5 years in group therapy at one time. I've been to several other psychiatrists and shrinks. I've been primal screened, gestalt, and rolfed, and I've done it. I know more about myself than is safe to know. So while I'm in this recovery program, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. It's a rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it, and it said, I am not a counselor. Evidently, there was some confusion about that. Those are the people that become speakers in AA. We've always known a lot of stuff that we need to tell you about. And so after 35 days, they let me go. They just turn us loose, don't they? Go forth, multiply, you know. And where do we end up? Here. Alcoholics Anonymous, the world's aftercare program. Did you know that there's no referrals from AA? Did you know that? There's no place you go where you walk in and you say, I'm from AA, they sent me here. This is it. We are the counselors. You stop and think about this. I've been married 3 times. I've been to a mental institution 2 times. And people asked me for relationship advice. I give it to them. I figure, hell, you can't hurt them. They're in AA. That's what people say, like, I'm afraid to sponsor people. What'll I tell them? I said, just make shit up. They don't know. Neither do you. Somehow it works. Nobody ever takes the advice anyway. Plus, you know, whatever advice I give them couldn't possibly be worse than what they're planning on doing anyway, you know? Really. True story, this guy comes to me, true story. And he says, I'm thinking about marrying the nude dancer. What do you think? And I looked at him and I said, it's probably not a good idea. But if you do, I'll come to the wedding. He married her. It was awful. And now he's married to a school teacher. For a long time with a kid. That's great, you know. But I learned something from that. He could not have married the school teacher if he had not married the nude dancer. It's just the way it is, you know. Everybody has to have their own experience. Two things happened to me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I think are just pure luck. The first one's probably the most important. When I got here, I just liked it. Nothing in my past would have led you to believe that Bill would enjoy AA, you know? I mean, I just liked it. The first meeting I went to was the Gong Show at the Hermosa Beach Alano Club. A lot of people say it wasn't really a meeting. Probably wasn't. It was crazy, loud, everybody's dressed up. It's Friday night, everybody's down at the Alano Club looking for love, and it was just a nutty meeting. And I remember clearly driving home that night thinking to myself, you know, this may not be so bad. You know, now, I'm an old hippie from the 60s. Weird has always attracted me. And it's like people, some weird stuff's going on, people are walking away, and I'm walking towards it going, what are they doing over there, you know? That's Alcoholics Anonymous to me. It's just weird. And in a positive way, in a fun way. Mostly it's really fun. You know, mostly there's a lot of laughter all the time. And I was intrigued by that. I wasn't put off by it. You know, I mean, I was attracted to it. The second thing that happened is I asked a guy to sponsor me. I asked a guy for help a couple of weeks after. You know, I saw him around a lot, and he's going to be your Sunday speaker, so it's always scary when he speaks after I do. And but this guy was in every meeting I was at. He was very prevalent. Seemed like he knew everybody. And I asked him for help, and he actually helped me, which doesn't always happen. And when you're new, you don't know how this thing works. The way you think it works is the way it's delivered to you. That's what your experience is normal in AA, because that's what you know. This guy said to me, read the doctor's opinion, make notes in the margin of what you agree with and don't. Be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock and we'll discuss it. So I read the doctor's opinion. I showed up at his house and he did not trust me that I'd read it. And he had me sit there and read it to him out loud. Rule number one when you're sponsoring people, make sure they read the book. Don't just tell them to read it and expect that they'll do it because they're criminal and they won't, you know, mostly. And read it with them. You could probably use it, you know. And each week I went to his house, we read another chapter in the book and we discussed it. We talked about things. He brought up things that were important to him. Parts of the book drew to my attention. I would ask questions. I would argue, you know. The whole God thing is stupid. We all know that. And most of us get here, and even if we believe in God, the one that you're trying to tell me about is probably not quite right. And but, you know, I'm of the intellectually atheist variety of alcoholic. That doesn't mean that I understand a lot about it. I've read some stuff, saw a movie or something, and then can spout it and parrot it back to you. And it seemed appropriate to me. The whole God thing was kind of stupid, and I would explain that to him. One time I'm in his kitchen, and he put his hand on my chest to stop me. Because sometimes you just have to stop me. And you can probably tell that. And he said, Bill, your opinion is absolutely irrelevant. We don't need you here. You need us. Resign from the debating society. I was hurt. This clearly was not therapy. He wasn't that interested in what my opinions were. He would listen up to a point, but then he would cut me off, and he would rarely argue with me. He didn't argue with me at all. Today, I have the same experience. One time, some time ago, this has happened several times, but the first time, this guy, it's time to do the third step. We're reading along. We read the third step prayer. I look at the guy and I go, are you ready to do the third step? And he said, no. Well, I said, why not? He says, I have a problem with God. And I looked at him and I said, me too. Let's pray. Now, how do you argue with that? What he said was, well, I don't even believe in God. And I go, nobody really does. Let's pray. You know? That's the Bill C. spiritual program. You know, it says here in the book, pray. What do you say we give it a shot? You know, what's your other option? You know? And the only reason people have a problem with the third step is they don't want to do the fourth step. And the reason they don't want to do the fourth step is they're getting closer to nine. And we're not doing that. You know? So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time with you arguing over concepts of God. I'll wait till you got more time, and then we'll sit out in my backyard and smoke cigars and talk about it. That's a lot more fun. And here's what I think's going on, for whatever it's worth. The first step says that we're powerless over alcohol. I believe they took it easy on us because they didn't want us to go screaming down the street. My experience is that I'm powerless over absolutely everything in my life. There is nothing at all that I have any control over. There is the illusion of power, you know, and it is clearly illusory. It's not real. And what I do is I look out in the world and I make judgments about things. This is good and that's bad. So we want to enhance this and stay away from that. That does not exist in nature. When you look at nature, there's no morality play going on in nature. The lion eats the lamb, and we don't think it should, but it does every time. So I make these judgments, and nothing changes. And I suffer. I suffer because of that. The source of all the suffering in my life is my inability to accept things exactly as they are. That doesn't mean I have to like it. I can have an opinion about it. Even if I want to change it, I have to accept it exactly as it is. And this first step, this whole idea of powerlessness, is a huge concept. And then once again, it's the source of all the suffering in my life, the illusion that I have some kind of power. It says that my life became unmanageable. I don't remember when it was manageable. I don't believe my life needs to be managed. It simply unfolds right in front of me. My job is to accept that. If I don't accept it, I suffer because it doesn't change. I can't fix it or change it in any fashion. The second step says I'm going to be restored to sanity, that this weird concept, this God thing, this thing that evidently has some power, whatever that might be, is going to restore me to sanity. What kind of sanity? Certainly enough sanity to not drink and use, but also enough sanity to be able to glimpse and see the powerlessness. Just the beginning of it, just a little bit. All I need is a little bit. And it's easy enough for me to say, I am truly powerless over alcohol and other mind-altering things. I mean, the reason God gave alcoholics cocaine is so we could drink more. That's what it's for. You know? These people that just do it all by itself, that's why they have that other program. I don't get that, you know? It's a drinking aid, you know? And then you smoke pot to take the edge off the cookie. Well, never mind. And, it's not an outside issue. It's an inside issue, you know? So the second step says, I'm going to be restored to some kind of sanity. The third step says I'm going to turn my life and will over to the weird concept in the second step. And I think it was nice of them to lead us to believe that we have some say in the matter. We're going to turn our life and will over to what already has it anyway. Right? But isn't that the alcoholic position? You know, there's the universe and me. Yeah. Yeah. I've been withholding myself from the totality of all things long enough. I'm going to acquiesce now and allow you to take me. Thank you very much. So what life and will is it talking about? The fourth step. The end result of living a life with seeming power: resentment, fear, broken relationships. What else is there? Isn't that what we bring here? How difficult can the inventory possibly be? Our resentments are very prominent. We know them. Just ask me. I will tell you, you know. So we make a list of those things. We do the resentments. And what we're looking for is the fourth column of that resentment list. It doesn't really say what was my part. There may be a part in some of it. What it says is, what are my faults and mistakes? What are my faults and mistakes? That's what we're looking for. Fears, of course we have fear, because this whole thing isn't working. This power that we think we have, it's not working, and we're scared to death because nothing's working at all. You can be 10 years sober and that can happen. You ever had somebody standing, you ever been sober like this happened to me at 10 years, and the woman is standing in front of me and she's looking at me and she goes, "You are not emotionally available for me." You ever had that? You ever raise your hand? Has anybody ever said that to you? You know what they mean by that when they say that? The illusion is that I've got something that they want and I'm withholding it. The truth is worse. I don't have it. I don't know that I don't have it. You've convinced me that I've got it, and I'm helping you look for it. And this dance is going to go on forever. Right? I'm not married to her anymore. Yeah. The third one has said that to me too, but I'm a little more flexible now. I realize that I'm missing some stuff, you know? I mean, the character defects are one thing, right? I mean, the character defects are aspects of my nature that don't work. What about the stuff that I don't have, that I never learned, you know? Those things are probably more critical. What about the stuff I've never learned? So the fifth step is how we physically and literally turn it over. We tell ourselves, maybe for the first time in our life, and another human being, and this power, this ineffable thing that we're trying to grab, and we seem just bent upon defining it, and it's almost indefinable, I think. I don't think it's almost. I think it's indefinable. But we tell it, go, "Here's my stuff. I'm pooped. Please take it. You know, I don't know what to do with it." And we do that. You can't do three without four and five. You can't turn it over unless you identify it and really get rid of it, literally tell somebody. Maybe this is when we first, the very beginning of taking responsibility for our own lives, we begin to get a glimpse that it's not them. And God, it sure looks like them, it smells like them, it's just them. You can't be an alcoholic if you don't know who they are, because they're doing it to us. You know, my friend Steve Lamb, he loves to say, he says, "Nothing is personal. People are just doing what they do, and I happen to be in the blast radius." You know, I love that. He's an ex-military guy, so of course it's an explosion, you know. And he says he loves blowing shit up, you know, so. And I'm convinced nothing's personal. I'm convinced of that. I don't always behave that way. I take things personal, but I know they're not, you know. I have some awareness that it's not. Stuff is just happening. It's just unfolding. This same guru that said he loved the drug addicts and all that stuff, we gave him a bumper sticker. Remember the "shit happens" bumper stickers? Remember those back in the day? We handed him one, and he goes, "Precisely! I've been saying this for years. Shit happens. It just happens." You know? He says, "Isn't it interesting that we call it shit? It's just stuff." You know? It's just stuff. Stuff is happening. It just happens all the time. It never stops. Life is dynamic. It's not static. We keep trying to wait. We're going to arrive somewhere. I don't think that's going to happen. Hasn't happened to me yet. I'm 70 years old. I'm still waiting to land, you know, and it just keeps evolving. My job is to try to watch the movie and be part of it when they ask me to step in. Six and seven are two paragraphs in the book. You say the prayer and it's over. You're going to be working those two steps for the rest of your life, you know. You know, the one thing about six and seven is we become willing, we just don't humbly ask, you know. But boy, we're willing, but we just don't ask, you know? And my experience with that as time goes on is I start to do the real work in AA, which is not the first 9 steps. That's not the work. That's just sober 101. It's just the bare beginning. Work hasn't started yet. But as I do that, these character defects will be presented to me in such stark living color. Now that I'm awake and aware, I can't avoid them any longer. And when that happens, it's the beginning of the end of it. And it just becomes too painful. 8 and 9, we make the list of people we've injured. We go out and we start making these amends. This is what most people do not do. Most people don't do this. They might mumble an apology to so-and-so and stuff, but they don't pay all the money back. They don't. And they're waiting around for their ship to come in, and I'm telling you, it ain't coming. It's not coming. If you're sitting out there tonight and you're saying to yourself, is this all there is? The answer is no, it's not. There's a lot more. There's a lot more. And until I can pay that money back, when I go and I go up to somebody and I've done this, and look them right in the eye and apologize for my behavior, for what I said or what I did, when I turn and walk away from that experience, I am changed right then. Just the experience of doing it. Alcoholics Anonymous, God is experiential. It's not conceptual. It's not a concept. It's not a belief mechanism. It's an experience. It doesn't matter what you believe about this God or this higher power. It's the experience of it is so phenomenal that the concept of it is irrelevant. We here experience it. We're out in the street with the hookers and the thieves. This is what we do. This is what Jesus did. He didn't spend a whole lot of time in the synagogue. He was out in the street with the hookers and the thieves, just like us in AA. And if he comes back, he's going to be sitting in the back row of one of your Alano clubs, and he's going to be looking like shit. And if you're not paying attention, you'll miss him. Or Buddha, or Mohammed, or whatever, you know. Alan Watts said the most powerful thing I think I've ever heard, or one of the top three anyway. He said, true faith is not knowing and having that be okay. I mean, I always believed that what faith was is I have a belief mechanism that I've cobbled together myself or gotten from someone else, and I have a belief mechanism, and I have faith that this belief mechanism is correct. That the way I believe, what I believe in, is the right belief. Watts is saying something much more profound, much more mystical. That true faith is having no belief mechanism and having that be okay. That everything is absolutely as it should be all the time. The evidence is astounding that everything is simply as it is. They asked the Lama, they said, what's the ultimate spiritual truth? And he said, all is well. And then he pauses, that wonderful Dalai Lama pause, as he's looking you in the eye, waiting for you to be quiet a little bit, and he repeats it very slowly. All is well. And I have trouble with that. You know, I believe it. I have faith that that's true. I just have trouble with it, you know, because I'm a human. 1 through 9 is about 10 to 15% of the program. And God, we suffer over it, don't we? We have year-long workshops and on working the goddamn steps and doing 15-column expanded inventories. And there's people out there doing it every year. Stop! You know? It's just another form of self-obsession. You know? Have I done many inventories? Absolutely. You know, I need to do one now. You know, but I'm pretty much sick to death of myself, man, you know. There's just not enough attention in the universe to satisfy me, and I'm tired of it. I'm not the attention, I'm just tired that I'm like that, you know. It's like, 10, 11, and 12, people say, are the maintenance steps. Maintain what? What are we maintaining now, you know? I'm of the school that it's no longer about not drinking. Although AA is really stringent about that, isn't it? This not drinking thing seems to be a real critical aspect of the program. We'd be a lot larger if we were looser on that, you know? The obsession was lifted. Grace. I didn't do anything for that. It's just so far, it's been lifted, you know? And I had a lot of fun with Dilaudid in the hospital the last couple of years, you know? But it's gone. It's all gone. It's lifted. I have no obsession. It's gone. I think what's going on now is for me to get comfortable enough to where I don't need to medicate myself, to where I have a decent life, where I feel I'm connected. I feel the connection, that I feel it. And I think that's what 10, 11, and 12, it's where we live. It's like 85 to 90% of the program. 10, 11, and 12 is where the real work is, the real work that we've been getting prepared for. 10 is the continuing inventory process. It's making an amends in the present moment. Like when you step on somebody's foot, you say, I'm sorry, right away. You don't wait a week and write an inventory about it and then go try to find the guy, you know? You have some awareness of what happened to me on March the 27th as I was awakened. 1985, March the 27th, I got awakened. I woke up. The rest of the journey is to take that awakening and have it evolve into an awareness where I'm actually aware that I'm awake and maybe there's something I can do with this. Maybe there's a reason why I'm here. Maybe there's a job for me to do, something. And I believe that's true. I know my purpose. When they transplanted my liver and I woke up and I realized I wasn't going to die because it got close. You start making plans, you know? I'll tell you something about that. I wasn't afraid. I was disappointed. I didn't want it to end like this. I have stuff I still want to do. There's more I would like to do in life. And I was just disappointed, but I was okay. I was kind of okay. And I woke up and I was not going to die. And Karen is sitting there with me. She said, no, you're not going to die. Dude, we made it. You know, we got a liver. It was stunning. It was incredible. It was an incredible experience. I started telling the surgeons and the doctors, anybody that would listen, I know that you've saved my life. And I want you to know I'm not going to waste this time. And I don't have to search for what my purpose is. I know what my purpose is. I've known it for 30 years. You know, I know what my purpose is. And I told him that. One doctor looked at me. You can always tell somebody that's got alcoholism in their family. You can always tell because they listen to you different. And you're in the liver department. They know, you know. They know. They don't ask you, who are all these people coming? They know. It's those people. It's them. It's, you know. This one doctor looked at me when I told him that. I held his hand. I said, I want you to know I'm not going to waste this time. I know what my purpose is. He looked at me. He leaned over and he goes, don't forget this. I went, okay, you know. So 10 is about self-awareness, not self-obsession, but watching yourself move through life. You can actually see what it is that you're doing to hinder your growth or, you know, the problems or even the pluses. You start looking at the plus side. You go, dude, you're pretty good at that, man. You know, it seems to be working for you. You can see it. And you can see what it is that you do that stands in your own way. You come to understand at depth it really isn't them. They are just doing what they do, and sometimes you happen to be in the scene. Could be anybody there. Sometimes you're the one that's causing the havoc. Sometimes it's you that's affecting other people. And you can see it. When I had my fingers through the chain link fence screaming, the reason I can tell you that story is I know now. It wasn't the umpire. It's just children's sports. I overreacted again. You know, wasn't the first time. 14 years sober, and this cop pulled me over for a traffic ticket, and I started yelling at him. Why don't you get a job that adds something to the society rather than detract from it? I'm perfectly capable of driving without your assistance. Thank you very much. You know, they don't like it when you talk to them like that. They get upset. I got out of my truck to go back and make amends to him because I realized what I'd done again, and he put his hand on his gun. I had a moment of clarity. He came back and said, what's going on? I started apologizing. I said, I had no right to speak to you that way. I should have never spoken. I realized you're just doing your job. It's my problem, sir. It's not yours. Calling him sir was really hard. And I couldn't look at him. I had my head down. It was the best I could do. He got so confused when I apologized to him. I imagine he's still thinking about that, you know? He let me go. He's just like... It didn't work again. So 10 is about making amends in the present moment, but seeing yourself the way you truly are. 11 is about getting close to whatever it is that saved our lives. this power, this undefinable thing, this totality, the oneness, the spirit of light, whatever you want to call it. I've heard some great definitions, you know. E equals mc squared. Energy equals, you know, the speed of mass times the speed of light squared. They can't define what energy is. Howard P. talks about it. He goes, what if it's spirit? What if it's spirit? What if dark energy is spirit? The boson particle. What if it's spirit? What if that's what we're tapping into? What if it is? Isn't that cool? You know, and I'm part of that. That energy is within me. We can't possibly be separate from each other. We can't possibly. This one guru that I sit with from time to time, I told him, I said, you know, there really is no self. He goes, oh, you're in the intermediate stage. I was kind of pleased to hear that I was intermediate, you know. And he said, Bill, it's everything. It's everything. The rocks, the trees, everything. We're not separate from anything. We're all star stuff. It's everything. And there's a you. There's a you. You like certain things, don't like other things. The key is to not be attached to that. And in the essence, that isn't who you truly are. In the 11th step, my sponsor loves to say, meditation is not extra credit. It's in the step. Now, in meditation, this is an interesting thing. This is a game-changing thing. In meditation, I can get quiet, sit somewhere comfortably, and feel the breath, focus my thinking on the breath going in and out of my nose. And then the mind will wander. That's what it does. It doesn't like the present moment. There's nothing for it to do. It wants to be in the past or in the future. We say things, don't we? We say things like, my head is out to get me. We talk about it in the third person, like it's separate from us. I think we've hit upon it, but we make it adversarial. And we talk about the ego needs to be crushed and smashed and all this stuff. You know, it just needs to be observed. It's like shining a light on a shadow. It just slinks off into the bushes. It doesn't like to be looked at. It thinks it's me. And I think it's me. I'm in collusion with the thing, you know. So when the mind wanders, we can see it. We notice that it's wandered, and we can gently bring it back to the breath. Absolute, conclusive proof that my thinking mind is not who I am. If it was, I couldn't see it. That changes everything. Thank God we can now stop working on ourselves. We're feeding the beast. It loves attention. As long as we're paying attention to it, it loves it, whether it's positive or negative. When I finally realized that, when that bit came true, all I have to do is look at it. I don't have to buy into it. I don't have to analyze it. I don't have to go down the rabbit hole with it. I don't have to identify it. I don't have to isolate it, you know, add it up and tell everybody about it, you know. I can stop that and just come back to the breath. Everything changes. Just that simple thing. The 12th step is what it's all about. The 12th step is the work. Should everybody sponsor? There's nothing else to do, you know? Everything else is an activity. And like us being here, and the committee in Harlan, activities are wonderful. The fellowship is like a warm blanket. The energy is real. It's one leg of the triangle. But it doesn't replace the action. What's the action? Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. My very life depends upon my constant thought of others and how I may help meet their needs. You know, do you think they were kidding? You know, I don't think so. A couple of rules. Yeah. Okay, a couple of suggestions. Like, put on the fucking parachute, you know? It's like, I did it, you know? So, always answer the phone. Get rid of caller ID. Just answer the phone. Stop controlling the experience. This is how it communicates with us. It calls us. You know, have faith that whoever's calling is supposed to be in your life, or they would not have called. Rule suggestion number 2, say yes to whatever they say. and you end up in Seaside. You know, while it's raining, and you're from Southern California. Sometimes you end up in Fargo, North Dakota in the winter, and that is not fair, you know. Other times you end up in Hawaii, you know. My experience of having done this for quite a long time is it changed my life, because left to my own devices, if I'm sitting in my living room watching my favorite rerun of Law and Order and you call, I'm not going to answer the phone. Is it inconvenient to live like that? Absolutely. Absolutely it's inconvenient. But I'm convinced that you are more important than my favorite rerun of Law and Order. And left to myself, I'll make those poor value judgments. It has changed my life. I could regale you with lots of stories of sponsorship. I can promise you a few things. Whatever prejudice you have, we'll walk across the room and ask you for help. Guaranteed. You want to confront your character defects? Sponsor people. You'll run into every one of them, you know? This guy came across the room and asked me to sponsor him. He says, I think I should tell you that I'm gay. I said, wouldn't you rather have a gay sponsor? He goes, no. He says, I don't have a problem being gay, but drinking is an issue. Who knew? Evidently, I thought something else, you know? Sometime later, I really got close to this guy. He was a wonderful guy. Sometime later, I asked him, how come you don't ever go to gay meetings? He goes, I'm going to tell you this one more time. I used to stand up at these podiums and say, if you were on medication, you weren't sober. Now, I didn't know anything about that, but I don't require knowledge or experience to form an opinion. I can just do it on the fly, you know? It's a skill that I have. And I heard a lot of other people say that, and I thought it was a real right-wing, badass opinion to have, so I just started saying it. Guy walked across the room, and he says, you know, will you help me? I think I should tell you that I'm bipolar. And I went, oh, geez, one of these losers. He came over to my house one night, but you can't say no. I'm a believer in that. You don't say no. You're my teacher. I used to think I was the teacher. No, you are sent to me to teach me. This guy came over to my house, and he came across the living room, and he curled himself up in my lap. He's a 40-year-old grown man, put his head in my neck, and just started sobbing at the pain of being alive. And I just held him and rocked him. Karen came through the living room and went, whoa. I mean, that will get your attention. I think the whole world is trying to medicate us for one. There's a lot of things I think about that. But I've seen that demon. I've seen it. Now when I see that guy, he's still around. He gave me a cake the other night. When I see that guy, I say, have you taken your medication? You know? And there's one thing for sure about those people. They definitely should not drink. You know, there's people around AA that will tell you that they don't think people on medication can have a spiritual experience. Isn't that an arrogant guy? I heard a guy say that one time. I went, man, I'm pretty arrogant, but I draw the line. Who am I to say who can have a spiritual awakening and who can't? I've seen a lot of incredible things around here. I'll leave you with all the medicated people are in. Another thing. How many people out there suffer from depression? Wow, that's more than the people in the nut house, man. It's like, God, you know. I'd like to apologize to you for all the horrible things I've said about you over the years. But after the surgery, I got really depressed, and I changed my mind. You know? I will leave you with this. And one of our speakers mentioned it earlier this weekend, it means a lot to me because I believe it. The essence of Alcoholics Anonymous. People will tell you that you got to give it away to keep it. No, that's not true at all. You got to give it away to even get it. Thank you.